or bricks? Which will it be? This is Blueprint for Living. I'm Jonathan Green. And this week in the last half hour, you can huff, you can puff, but we're talking bricks. Colin Bissett is a writer, broadcast and design expert, a friend of the program and noted masonry bore. Colin, welcome.
Thank you. I'm not sure about that. Masonry bore. I'll take it.
When do humans first make a brick?
Well, they go back an awfully long way. I was reading about bricks being first used at 7000 BC or wow. BCE, which is a long time. I mean, we're talking mud bricks here, of course. But I mean, you know, we see bricks being used in the Roman Empire. We see them being used in Egypt. But they're fairly sort of rough. And in fact, the word brick didn't really come into sort of use until about the 15th century. People talked about tiles rather than bricks.
And in the 15th century, when that word emerges, what is it describing?
Well, it is describing a brick as we would recognise it, but it's gone through quite a sort of transformation from being just something that's just made of clay and whatever's to hand that is then sort of baked in the sun to something that is actually baked in a kiln. Mm. Sort of. So, and this is the beauty of the brick, I think, the fact that they just use whatever is around. And so you get the sort of the clay of the region being seen, the colour of it coming through. So you get in places in medieval cities like Toulouse in France, you get the red brick. It's very sort of notable, this colour. It's something that later on is you know, they change the colour through dyes and pigments and minerals, different, you know, adding things.
Is there a golden age for the brick?
I think the golden age, I mean, you'd sort of say medieval times are sort of pretty much are pretty golden, because we've got, and I'm really sort of medieval going into Renaissance times. I'm thinking sort of there's a fantastic cathedral at Albi. I keep talking about France, but it's near Toulouse, but it's like a fortress. It looks like a fortress. It's a very strange building. But we've also got Hampton Court, you know, that's a very famous brick building, that's sort of 1500s. But all the same, these bricks are made on site, you
yes.
know. And that's, so when we go into a golden age, if you talk about a golden age, I think really you begin to go into the 19th century, the Industrial Revolution. That really changes the way we start seeing bricks. And that's because of uniformity and because of things like there were new methods of grinding down the clay into a finer paste, and new kilns that provided a more even heat. So you got a very good brick that could, you know, it was reliable, whereas some bricks were crumbly, or in you know, before that time, there were all sorts of sort of types of bricks. I mean, we've got a sort of golden age of brick, I suppose, in a way. I'm thinking in Sydney at the very beginning of the 19th century with Hyde Park Barracks and Francis Greenway's churches. I mean, they're all in brick.
Mm. That's the great virtue of just being of the earth.
Exactly.
I built my house of straw. I built my house of hay. I toot my flute. I don't give a hoot and play around all day.
Jim Fogarty is a landscape architect. Jim, bricks in the garden, a sense of form, a sense of structure.
They can add so much, you know, and people forget that you can play with perspective. You can make a space feel wider or longer. You can direct traffic, you know, all this by the simple act of using bricks.
And a brick in that red, in that green, it's a beautiful combination too.
It is. And I think there's a greater appreciation for bricks nowadays because they're and often handmade too.
Yep.
That they're a natural material. They live a long time. They last a long time. They don't tend to crack like concrete products. They can be reused, recycled. I mean, secondhand bricks are so popular in gardens. But even crush bricks used as a gravel or, you know, so their life cycle just goes on and on and on.
What a flexible little thing is your brick.
They are, they are. You know, and often you'll see in jobs, bricks that might have been used on a house wall, now used as a landscape paving material. So, you know, often bricks have a lot of history tied in behind them.
That sort of structure in landscaping too, it's sort of a way of us putting a bit of form into a wild environment. It's a bit of a contrast between those two things.
No, you're right, because with bricks you get the whole delineation of the grout line, see? And people can get quite disturbed by an ongoing grout line. So with bricks you can break those lines by using, say, basket weave or stretcher bond or herringbone.
A herringbone is a favourite.
And you can tweak the herringbone to 45 degree. Yeah?
I once made a beautiful brick circle in the middle of a garden, which was... took some faffing about. It was gorgeous, though.
Well, see, and that brings a whole other element because, of course, with bricks, you can use them laid on flat, you can use them laid on edge, you can use them laid on end.
Up as an edge.
Well, yeah, but it's almost like a little cobble. Now, I've had a brick company make cobbles for a project before, so you've just got those little sort of half bricks which work really well in a circular.
Is this where you start? Is it important in that landscaping task to set down this framework, to put in that skeleton before anything else?
Well, it is, because as you say, the bricks are forming the bones of the garden, the structure, the layout, the direction. You're going to guide people to walk into the garden using pathways or paving. It's the element of curiosity. But then it's conflicting with that sort of natural element of landscaping, which is the planted world. You know, the foliage, more soft textures and things like that. So you get this very formal delineation with bricks, which just contrasts really nicely with foliage textures.
And it's kind of nice too when that garden is connected to a house, that structure, that sort of built structure into the garden, in a way brings those two things together.
And that's exactly the point. If you've got a beautiful brick feature wall, in vertical, that you can bring that out in a horizontal element out into the landscape.
What's your favourite thing to do with a brick in a garden?
I love herringbone patterns. And see, what's quite popular now is this notion of being influenced by, say, I call it Tetris paving, where you're not cutting the edge of the paving, so the bricks are just running out into this sort of organic zigzag sort of delineation around the edges.
And that's a spot for a plant. That's a spot for
spreaded
leaves.
Well, it can then
go
even to gravel and rock and plants, yeah. So it goes from being very formal and made and constructed to a little bit more organic with gravels and rocks to very organic with your planted world.
What a glorious thing.
Bricks can do a lot of stuff.
Jim Fogarty is our landscape architect. Design expert, writer, broadcaster, Colin Bissett does all these things. Colin, the brick, it's an extraordinary medium in that it has a sort of a metaphorical sense about it. It almost bespeaks certainty.
Well, and there's a tremendous humbleness to it, I think, as well. The very fact that you or I could make a brick of some sort, and then we could make a wall, and then therefore we could make a structure. And so there's a sort of domesticity about it, which is often, you know, still used. And that's not to say it wasn't used in, you know, making enormous stations and train sheds and factories, but that's often because it's fireproof, which is a very important thing. But generally it's used in the home. We see it in a domestic environment. And so it's something we warm to, I suppose.
Coziness, Colin, but also an air of respectability.
Well, it became respectable. It was something that used to be sort of covered over and unseen. But then with these new bricks, it became used and seen. It was an honest material. And that was something we saw in Queen Anne Revival buildings in the late 19th century in Britain. And that was a big influence on the Federation architecture of Australia, where we get the sort of tuck pointing, that fine line of mortar standing out around the brick, really showing off the brick.
Yeah, it became a technology to be proud of.
Absolutely. Something, and it pre-sort of figures the modernist movement, this sort of honesty. It's an honest material, something to be proud of.
We think red brick, we think of hearth, all these things. It's a very, very associative medium.
Definitely. I mean, we might have a house that's got a brick fireplace, but there's no other brick anywhere else. So it's very symbolic. Partly that's obviously because it is fireproof. But it's gone into the language. We understand that language. It's quite interesting though that there is a complete brick skyscraper in Chicago. It's got load bearing walls. It's completely made of brick. It was made in the 1890s, and with colossally thick walls, the Monadnock building. This is so it's not domestic. It's an oddity. I must say, it is an oddity.
the last half hour here on Blueprint, and we're talking bricks.
I built my house of sticks.
Sharon Saloom is a chef and restaurateur. Sharon, I want to eat a brick.
Who doesn't want to eat a brick? It's a pretty amazing pastry, isn't it?
It is. Tell me about this. I mean, make one for me.
Okay, so brick is basically made, it's a very, very thin bread, I guess, as such. The other name for it is wala, which means paper, which perfectly describes it. So wala is paper in Arabic, and so the thickness of it is very paper thin, so that makes sense that it's called wada. But it's made with a really strong flour, so normally a bread flour, or baker's flour, and a lot of people tend to add a little bit of semolina, fine semolina to it, just to give it a bit of elasticity when you're cooking it as well. A little bit of salt and a little bit of water and a little bit of vegetable oil. I recently saw that Paul Wolfer actually adds a little bit of apple cider vinegar to it and a little bit of sugar too, just for a different flavour. So normally you can make that ahead. It's quite a runny pastry when you make it. And so what you do is you leave that in the fridge overnight, and then the next day you just have a pot of boiling water. So the Westerner way of making it is to boil a pot of water and just put a flat skillet on top and brush a non-stick skillet, obviously. But, you know, a little bit of oil always helps, just a very thin layer that's kind of wiped on with paper towel. And you can brush that pastry on, and you end up with a very thin bread.
Wow.
Paper-like bread.
Like
paper,
as you say. What am I going to put in that? I hear rumours of tuna and egg.
Yes, well, that's quite a common recipe. So putting in a really good quality tuna in there, cooked tuna and egg. Greg Malouf's quite famous for making a Moroccan bastilla with it. So it's used quite often in bastilla. So to make, you know, the bread, so the wada or the brick pastry. And he's put, I think, a whole quail in there before. So it's bistia with quail and pigeon. I think he's done that as well. So that's quite a beautiful dish that he does, and he just throws that whole into the oven and gives that bread a really good crunch also. So, you know, you've got a few different options. There's a chicken and sumac and parsley and onion kind of mix that you can put in there also, and some people use the brick pastry to make that kind of dish, which is also known as msakhan, which is often a Palestinian or Syrian kind of chicken pastry that we make as well.
So this is such a standard across so many Middle Eastern cuisines, is some sort of a little brick pastry parcel, a little half moon, a triangle, a finger?
Yeah, well, it tends to be just a round, kind of like a round sheet, I guess, is the best way to describe it. So a lot of our breads tend to be round. And, you know, so and often they're packed in, you know, packets of seven, funnily enough. They often say it's one for each day, but, you know, we generally go through one packet a day. You know, we use it for a variety of reasons. You could just use it, you know, with dips and normal food and just as a side thing with, you know, as a bread side as well. So, yeah, there's a few uses for it. And we all have different ways of making it. There's also the connection, I guess, in the way that it's made is, you know, traditionally it's made over hot coals, you know, with just a hot pan on top. So that's how it's made overseas still, you know, but it's not as easy for us to kind of get into the backyard and chuck some coals together.
But it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, this is such a thing, whether it be a brick or a borek or a Cornish pasty.
Yeah.
It's that thing of a container, a filling. It's such a human staple.
Yeah, it sure It sure is. And I think, you know, it's, you know, unless you're gluten intolerant or have some kind of intolerance, it's, you know, bread is just such a big staple of our diet, especially in Middle Eastern cuisine. So it's a big part of our food and the dishes. And, you know, you generally don't have a meal without bread being there. So, you know, having that kind of bread is an even greater treat, I think, as well.
Mm. Sharon Saloom, thank you for bringing us another kind of brick.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Can a brick, Colin Bissett, be truly modern?
Oh, I think so. I'm sitting at the ABC in Sydney, and next door is the Chow Chak Wing building, the Frank Gehry building. That's all brick. Mm. So that's dancing around the corner there. And also there's a fantastic sort of brick lattice addition to Tate Modern in London that's just been completed. So yes, it can most definitely be very modern.
How long can they last?
Well, I think the brick companies would probably say probably forever, because I think there's no reason for them. It depends how they've been made. I mean, if I've seen bricks where they've been sort of weeping salt, that sort of thing, and they've got corroded and softened. But generally today, I think because of the high temperatures that they're cooked, they're pretty indestructible. Which makes them very, very appealing, and, you know, given the thermal mass and acoustic sort of potential that they've got, you know.
I build my house of stone. I build my house of bricks. I have no chance to sing and dance, cause work and play don't mix.
Brian Thompson is a chimney repairer. He specialises in repointing and in brickwork. Brian, g'day.
G'day, how you going?
The brick chimney, this is an iconic thing. This is the... In so many places as you travel around, the last thing standing, the last remnant of a building is that brick chimney.
Because it's the first thing. That's all that people forget. It's actually what the structure of the building's built off. So the chimney is always the first thing that goes in. It's always the first thing that the structure of the whole entire building, period homes, is anchored off.
Do we still do things that way?
No, not at all. Chippies are taken over there. So you have to remember too, with the chimneys and the brickwork themselves, it was the bricklayer who controlled the whole building. So the man who was the important person was the bricklayer. He was the builder because he had all the knowledge.
And the way in which those period homes were built is totally different to what we might expect.
Definitely, because of the simple fact that one thing we have different now is throwable material. So we cut something, if we have a piece, we dump it.
Yeah.
Right? So we go, oh, okay, man labour is more important because it's time. Back then, time was irrelevant because men were worth nothing. The materials were worth more than the guys. So nothing was
exposed.
Nothing's
thrown away.
Even the bricklayers, when they were building with brickwork, when they cut the mortar off, it was kept and reused.
So that Victorian brick home that so many people either know or live in, how was that constructed?
Well, in theory, what they did is they would have had a plan from, they would have bought a plan. Well, a preset plan, because there wasn't in those periods, say, as many architects as we want, because it would have been English plants. So all the design were based around English structures. So they were usually shallow, very shallow footings. So the footings being bluestone, so that created the anchor. So it suited us in the early days in Victoria because the ground was stable where we were mainly building. And as time went on, we moved out, we got further away from stable soil, which, you know, sands and so forth. So in reality, it was built with limal and sand. That was basically the structure, brickwork. And the whole concept is mass load. So gravity is what's actually anchoring the whole thing together.
And that brickwork, now we're used to seeing people clambering all around the outside of a building.
That's right. And so what you've got to remember with those period buildings especially is that bluestone was the original material that we used because it was viable and it was cheap, but then we had to actually create the bricks. So the original bricks that came in to Australia were ballast bricks, came in on the boats.
Mm-hmm.
So they were a soft material from the UK. So not particularly good material. And as we went on, we started creating our own bricks. So we started getting things like the hawthorn. So we had the Hawthorne press brick, which everybody loves and adores for the Hawthorne style brick, where it's black and it has that sort of manganese look through it.
And that's the nice thing about a brick, it's regional, depends on the clay of a place.
Exactly. And so reds were harder to get in the earlier days, and creams were more or less an expensive product, but they're all air-dried mainly. They weren't kiln dried. So the strength of the material was relative to how they made it. Mm. The whole point of the brickwork itself was relative to what they could get, right? So we didn't use wood, so because we didn't have any chippies, bricks were easy to get and you could build load and mass. So in theory, the thicker the wall, the stronger the wall. So we made the material a solid lump and then the brickwork was built on top of it. So the chimneys were a solid mass. So in theory, they could be anything up to 5,000 bricks, depending on how high you wanted to go with them. They were built, tuck pointed, and then everything else come off them.
No wonder they sit there forever.
That's right, because as long as that ground stays stable, they will sit there forever and a day. So this is the beauty of a fireplace and a chimney.
Tell me about the internal scaffold.
When they did a lot of these houses, right, because they're sitting side by side to each other or they're touching each other as in the UK, what they used to do was more or less have one single scaffold. And one scaffold would have been built out of wood. It would have been internally built inside the building. And then everything would have been built off that. Subsequently, bricklayers lent over and built overhand. The chimneys were built internally, so they were actually building inside that framework and up it went. And then as they did the outside of the building, things started, you had to reach out instead of reach in. So this whole theory of how wonderful the old bricklayers were, I have a big question on that one. The modern bricklayer is far more skilled than the old guys ever were. There's no two ways about that because of what we're dealing with. But at the same token, the bricks were softer, they were manageable. You could actually physically get them and actually rub them with a stone and make them fit.
Brian, thank you. Brian Thompson is a modern bricklayer. He's a chimney repairer. His specialty is in repointing and brickwork. And Colin Bissett as a writer and design expert. Colin, the last word in bricks probably takes us to the world of play, to Lego.
To Lego. Were you a Lego boy?
I was, yes.
They were quite good, weren't they?
But back in the day when it was just bricks, now it seems to be a little bit preformed, however.
It's evolved, yes. I mean, in Britain they had a horrible version called made by Airfix called Better Builder, which fell to pieces. So Lego, you'd build something and it would just... you'd destroy it in a minute. But Lego stuck together and that was just so fantastic.
What's its story?
Well, I think it came out of... It's Danish, of course. Its maker, Ole Christiansen, used to make wooden toys. His workshop burnt down. He got interested in the idea of making something out of plastic. And so he formulated his own specialised Lego brick, which had hollow tubes inside for stability. And he changed the sort of plastic. And it was just an incredible success. So 1958, that was launched. And, you know, 10 years later, he was building Legoland, you know, a sort of play park, pleasure park in Denmark, and they've gone around the world. So it continues to sort of be an immense success, huge success.
Is there any reason why that process, the way in which the Lego brick works, is that a thing which is ever incorporated in full scale?
Well, somebody made a proper full-scale Lego house, I think, didn't they? I'm not sure that's what you mean. But I think that idea of, you know, we get polystyrene bricks now that are then rendered. So that idea of the sort of Lego, the ease of and lightness of something that also has thermal mass, is usable in the real world, not just for kids.
See, Colin, now we need a fourth pig to build a house from Lego.
But what would its name be?
Well, that's a very good question. Colin, thank you so much for your thoughts on bricks. Colin Bissett has been with you. He's a writer, broadcaster and design expert. You also heard from Jim Fogarty, landscape architect, Brian Thompson, chimney repairer, repointer and man of many bricks, Sharon Saloom, restaurateur. Your producers, Amira Adler-Gillies and Buffy Gorilla, technical production by Ari Gross. I'm Jonathan Green, and that has been The Last Half Hour this week on Bricks.